Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell, and this is episode 15. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Mark Singleton. This was a pretty big episode for me. Mark's work has been tremendously influential in the field of yoga studies and has greatly inspired my own work and aspirations to go on to grad school and to carry out this type of research. Mark's work has also been heavily criticized, controversial, and I would say quite misunderstood. So it was great to take the time to sit down with Mark and talk to him about his journey in yoga and academia and reflect upon his research and its impact. I'm also excited to announce that Mark will be offering an online course for us here at Yogic Studies entitled YS113, Yoga's Past, Present, and Future. This will be our first offering of the new year, 2021. The course runs live from January 4th through the 29th, and enrollment will open on December 21st. We hope that you'll consider joining us for this exciting and unprecedented opportunity to study directly with Mark Singleton, who sadly, as you'll hear at the end of this episode, has recently announced his retirement from the field. Mark Singleton's research interests lie in the intersection of tradition and modernity in yoga. He was research assistant to Dr. Elizabeth De Michaelis at Cambridge University's Dharam Hinduja Institute of Indic Research in 2002 through 3, and he went on to complete a PhD at Cambridge's Faculty of Divinity on the modern history of yoga. He taught undergraduate and postgraduate courses at St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico between 2006 and 2013. His numerous books include Yoga in the Modern World, Rutledge 2008, edited with Gene Byrne, Yoga Body, The Origins of Modern Posture Practice, Oxford University Press 2010, in which we focus on heavily in this episode, Gurus of Modern Yoga, Oxford University Press 2014, edited with Ellen Goldberg, and Roots of Yoga, Penguin Classics, published recently in 2017 with James Mallinson. He's also written numerous articles, book chapters, and encyclopedia entries on yoga. As listeners will know, Mark has been working on what is the now concluding five-year Hatha Yoga project. His work focused primarily on the history of physical practices that were incorporated into or associated with yoga in pre-colonial India. Mark is involved in the critical editing of three of the project's core texts, the Yoga Chintamani, Hatha Sanketa Chandrika, and the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati. He's also writing a new monograph on the subject of yoga and technology, which we talk about briefly at the end of this episode. All right, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Mark Singleton. All right, I am here with Mark Singleton. Mark, welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. It's really a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you very much, Seth. It's a pleasure to be here.
And where are you tuning in right now for our listeners?
I am speaking from the northwest of Spain in Galicia.
Wow. And you've recently relocated there?
Yeah, I bought a house here a couple of years ago, and I'm living here full time now. And it's right on the Atlantic coast and a very beautiful spot. This is where I'm operating from and where I am, you know, in these times of COVID and restricted travel. This is where I'm mostly based at the moment.
Yeah. And not to get into all of that too much, but just to acknowledge it's an incredibly strange and difficult time. I'm all the more appreciative of your time and to get to have these conversations right now. It's really an honor to have you here, Mark. I've been looking forward to this conversation for some time, and the opportunity to get to talk to you about your truly groundbreaking and influential scholarship. We've got a lot to discuss today and somewhat limited time frame today. Some things I want to get into is, of course, your monograph, Yoga Body, which has been incredibly influential in the field of yoga studies and beyond. I want to talk about your more recent work on roots of yoga and this recently concluded Hatha Yoga project coming to the end of 5 years here. And then some of your current work that you've been doing. But before we get into all of the research and the scholarship, I think it might be helpful for listeners and even for myself to just hear a little bit about your story. And how did you come into yoga and then into academia? And how did you end up, you know, doing a PhD on yoga?
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Seth. It's really great to be talking to you about this. And we've had conversations around these topics over the years as we've our paths have crossed on the kind of academic circuit. Mm. I started off studying yoga practically, about 25 years ago or a little bit longer. And really sort of quite quickly getting into the kind of academic study of it. And I think it's sort of a predisposition. I'm sort of, you know, conditioned to look at things that way in some way. And I came as a practitioner who had spent quite a lot of time in India already. I'd been studying yoga, trying to sort of discover more about yoga in India for about 3 years. And then when I came back to the UK, I happened upon an institute in Cambridge where I was studying, where I had studied, where I'd done a master's and was actually partway into a different PhD. Mm. I discovered this institute called the Dharam Hinduja Institute of Indic Studies. Mm. That was headed by Elizabeth de Michaelis, who of course was one of the sort of pioneers of this study of modern yoga. And when I heard what Elizabeth was doing and what the rest of the people working there were doing, I thought, that's really what I want to do. That seems to answer so many of the questions that I had as a practitioner who'd been exposed to lots of different yoga, different forms of yoga up until that point, both in the UK, also in France, in the United States to some extent, and also during those years in India, you know, really going, I was going far afield, trying to find out everything I could.
You were teaching yoga at that time too, is that right?
I was teaching yoga at that time, yes. Yes.
And were you affiliated at that time, at least, with a particular school or lineage of modern yoga?
Yeah, I did two teacher trainings. I did a teacher training first in the Satyananda school, so the Bihar school of yoga, which is quite well known and one of the possibly the biggest teacher training school in northern India. So I was there in northern India, and I also did some training in their southern branch, and then qualified as a teacher in that. And then after that, I did an Iyengar teacher training. So the teachings of BKS Iyengar, mm-hmm. That are also very well known and sort of foundational for popular yoga practice, let's say in the wider world. So yes, I was a yoga teacher. Mm.
And then your experiences both in India and in the UK as a practitioner, as a teacher, they were starting to, I think like many of us who kind of have, I myself have a very similar story, right, of kind of coming up in that practitioner environment and then starting to read some of the extant literature and scholarship available at the time and all of these questions starting to mount about where all of this stuff is actually coming from, right?
And exactly.
You had art. Simultaneously started your academic training, doing a master's, and then you discovered the work that Elizabeth de Michaelis was doing at Cambridge and had a sense that you wanted to go on for doctoral studies?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I started out as a researcher. I was, researching in that institute, modern yoga, the history of modern yoga. And it's funny, now, after sort of 15 or 16 years or 17 years later, in fact, my God, how quickly time goes. If we think back to those times, there really wasn't an understanding. There wasn't even a sort of a, you know, a sense of that there was a thing called modern yoga. It, you know, it remained to be theorized, it remained to be worked out. So it was very much the beginning of this field of inquiry that we now see burgeoning and blossoming, and you know, lots of people now sort of involved in working out this history, this more recent history of yoga. So I did a year as a year of research working there as a paid researcher within this institute, and then I decided to go on and do a PhD in the history of yoga, in the modern history of yoga, building on, in some respects, the work of Elizabeth de Michaelis and also of Joseph Alter in the United States, who were two of the key early pioneers of this study, and who brought these phenomena that we sort of group under this umbrella term modern yoga into focus for the first time, because I think for various reasons that you'll know, it had been hidden and sort of sidelined, very much sidelined in favor of the study of you know, so-called classical yoga, the more serious yoga. And practical yoga wasn't deemed a serious object of study. So at the time it was quite new, it was quite cutting edge. Now, of course, it's much better known, but that's how I got into it. That's how I you know, I began this kind of journey of investigation that's still ongoing.
Yeah, it's really interesting to reflect back on that time, maybe early 2000s, and now where we're at today. And there's a lot of things, I think, that we sort of just take for granted about what we know about yoga's past and present and all of this. But at this time that you're talking about, there was so little that had actually been charted critically. And you mentioned the work of Elizabeth de Michaelis and Joseph Alter. I think around 2004-05, they both had these books that were published. I think there was a couple other works that came out at that time as well. That strikes me as like a big watershed moment for modern yoga. And yes, then, of course, your work as kind of continuing that and pushing the conversation and discourse further. So talk a little bit about, and I don't think everybody realizes that your book, Yoga Body, which was published in 2010, so we're now actually, this is, I guess, the 10th year anniversary of that book, believe it or not.
Yeah, coming into the 11th year now.
People might not realize that book came out of your dissertation project, and how it kind of, talk a little bit about how the project developed and how it builds on and relates to your thesis advisor, Elizabeth de Michaelis's pioneering work.
Sure. So the book came about, the PhD came about, as they say, as a result of what was initially a very sort of broad inquiry into all the expressions of yoga that we could find, really, in the sort of modern sense, or in yoga practice that was somehow outside of the traditional environments of yoga practice, let's say ascetic culture within India, or more quote unquote traditional forms of yoga practice. So yoga practice often taught in the English language, yoga forms that had traveled around the world and that were, you know, known outside of those traditional contexts. So I began with quite a sort of widespread and quite wide-ranging study of everything that we could find. We were gathering material, as you know, within this institute as part of this modern yoga research project. Elizabeth de Michaelis's book, Yoga in
her book, Modern Yoga.
Sorry, yeah, thank you very much. I was getting confused with Joseph Alter's book, Yoga in Modern India, which I sort of associate the two because I read them both at the same time in manuscript form. You know, I was very lucky to be sort of, you know, to be able to sort of see this research as it sort of developed. And what she was doing was studying in particular the work of Vivekananda, who, as we know, was one of the real pioneers of yoga, who took yoga and taught it for the first time as a kind of practice that was available for the uninitiated and for people outside of India. And, you know, he was doing this mostly in the United States. And what she suggested was that the way that Vivekananda taught was very much influenced by factors that you might call, again, non-traditional. That's to say, European philosophy, European ideas about science and psychology, crucially. You know, Vivekananda was very sort of connected with William James. She also spoke and wrote extensively about the esoteric tradition into which Vivekananda was, in which he was very much involved during his time in the United States. And the result of that, which was a very particular vision of yoga for Americans, essentially. You know, these books, particularly Raja Yoga, published in 1896, became a kind of blueprint, she argued, Elizabeth argued, for the experiments in yoga that would then follow. And so her basic argument was that this was in some respects a rupture, even though it's a continuation with tradition, it's an outgrowth of the larger yoga tradition. It's also in some senses new, insofar as it brings in all these other elements, these cultural and intellectual and philosophical, psychological elements into its teaching. Mm. And so as a result of that, study, she came up with a typology, which sort of forms the core of the thesis, I think, of different kinds of yoga. Mm-hmm. And one of these, I won't go through the typology, but one of these she called modern postural yoga, which is to say those practices that we're so familiar with today and that are based on the practice of asana. So in the end, what I did through the PhD was to focus on this aspect. It wasn't originally supposed to be the only aspect, but it proved to be sufficiently rich for to sort of provide for the material for analysis for a PhD. So that's what I focused on, was the culture of asana as it emerged and as it developed both within India in the 19th and 20th century, and also around the world. So how asana was understood, how asana was practiced, how asana in this sort of modern context was reflected back older traditions of asana, older traditions of yoga, but also reflected these new influences from different disciplines of body culture, you might say, like the worldwide physical culture movement, which was sort of exploding around the world in the 19th century into the 20th century, like sort of body work within a psychotherapeutic framework, like what I call in the book harmonial gymnastics, like these kinds of what I think of as independent traditions of of body-centered spirituality, so accessing the spiritual realms through the body, that have nothing, it seems to me, in the first instance, really to do with yoga, but subsequently do start to mix and merge with yoga. So really, the thesis was and the book, it's a cultural history of these understandings of the body and of the understandings and development of yoga that emerge as a result of this intermixing of all these different factors. So it's trying to describe really that, what it is, why it is that today yoga is popularly often identified with asana practice rather than with meditation, let's say, or with pranayama practice, with the breath control practices, which at different times and within Indian tradition have really been at the core and the center of practice.
Right.
So that, in a nutshell, that's what I was doing.
Because Elizabeth de Michaelis's work kind of brilliantly identified the late 19th century folks like Swami Vivekananda, and others from the Arya and Brahmo Samaj in India, part of this kind of Indian Renaissance, Hindu Renaissance, as kind of a birthing moment for what she calls modern yoga, right?
Yeah.
But her, and then she introduces this typology of different types of modern yoga, including, as you said, she coins this term, modern postural yoga, which is now got an acronym. I mean, people refer to it as MPY, and it's something you hear even in modern yoga discourse. So it's important to understand where that comes from. But I think what her book didn't do, and where your work, as I see it, picks up, is her book did not explain why, if Vivekananda kind of marks the origins or birthing moment of modern yoga, and yet he didn't really teach postures or asana. And in fact, as your book shows, he actually had a particular disdain for asana, or at least for hatha yoga, that he's actually quite clear about in some of his writings. And so what then accounts for this focus, this central emphasis on asana, on posture, that, as you say, today, now when somebody even thinks of the word yoga, they associate it with physical posturing and stretching. So what accounted for, you know, this huge change, if the origins of modern yoga were more focused on a meditational yoga, the Raja Yoga for Vivekananda in his interpretation of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, where did this explosion of interest in asana come from, right? So I see that, am I right? That was like that was kind of an important intervention that you were trying to make at that time.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's perhaps worth considering first why Vivekananda didn't include asana, because asanas are there in the Indian tradition and, you know, have always been there with different purposes. You know, the very early asanas, of course, are about sitting down and staying put. Then in Hatha yoga, they start to be put to different uses, to have different purposes, to become more complex and more numerous. But so, as you say, in these first years of this yoga renaissance, as it's been called, Vivekananda and most of those who followed him didn't really put an emphasis on asana. It wasn't there. And yes, he some of his statements seem to suggest a kind of disdain, not just for asana, but also for hatha yoga more generally. So the question is, why is this? And Vivekananda's a really complex figure. Like, you know, so he speaks out against hatha yoga. But he says, you know, life is short. Hatha yoga takes a long time. You may as well actually just to go straight to the heart of the matter and do a spiritual yoga. And that's, you know, where he sort of gets his ideas about Raja Yoga from. But if you look at his book, Raja Yoga, in fact, he's borrowing so much of the apparatus from Hatha yoga that you sort of wonder, you know, he's a contradiction in many ways. But I think, and the case that I made in the book and in the PhD was that he's kind of inherited a distrust, a sort of cultural distrust of the yogi, that's to say the hatha yogi, who had been presented in sort of the ethnography of the time, in the scholarship of the time, Western scholarship, but also, you know, it exists within the Indian culture as well, of the hatha yogi as an outsider of that, you know, this sort of traditional practitioner of asana, etc., as somebody who is uncivilized or outside the pale of proper, you know, sort of respectable society, let's say, and that there are many examples of the presentation of these yogis in postcards, in photography, in journals, where it's clear, you know, that they're simply not respected. And I think the case that I made was that Vivekananda was reacting to that he needed to sort of clean things up for his presentation of yoga. And of course, he's gone to the United States as an ambassador for Hinduism, for India, and also in later years for yoga itself. So he's trying to present something that's apart from this this sort of image of yoga as magic, as involving drugs, possibly involving illicit sex, you know, all these sorts of dark and salacious elements that that people looking into India love to see, you know, and to present as this sort of strange religious life of India. Well, he's trying to clean things up and present something that is acceptable and that can be practiced by respectable people. And so I think in some respects that's one half of the answer of why asana isn't strongly present in this first sort of renaissance of this first wave of the renaissance of yoga, starting with him. But maybe just before I get into the second part, just to say that, you know, another contradiction is that Vivekananda had a training in Hatha Yoga with a guru called Pavhari Baba. Like it's well known that his guru was Ramakrishna, the great saint, that, you know, really famous saint of India, Ramakrishna. But also, you know, he did actually an apprenticeship with Pavhari Baba, and it's this sort of story that I recount in the book, where he learns Hatha Yoga. So he knew some of this, he knew what it was. But I think what he's doing is trying to present you know, something that's cleaned up and acceptable for a larger audience, let's say.
Right, because he's very much a product of his time. He's, as you said, he's presenting not only yoga, but Vedanta and Hinduism in the English language on the kind of global stage. If you think of the World Parliament of Religions in 1893, coming out, you know, out of India, he's an emissary, he's a missionary for all of this. And so he has to present himself in a certain very posh, very elite, and in a language, right, that's on par with other world religions like Christianity, and in particular Protestantism. And so he's in some ways, as you say, kind of cleaning up certain things from maybe Tantra or Hatha Yoga or things that at that time maybe were deemed impure to certain elite sensibilities at that time. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the motivation that we're seeing here. And of course, you know, as you say, that the World Parliament of Religions was a gathering that he turned up at in 1893 in Chicago, in order to bring together the world religions, you know, for the first time, all in the same venue from many different cultures. And he presented himself as the representative of Hinduism alongside, you know, the Christian delegates, Buddhist delegates. And so there was a kind of challenge here, which was to present Hinduism as a world religion, not just on a par with these other religions, but in fact better than them in some ways, you know, that. And so instead of the common idea at the time, and sort of perhaps the idea in the minds of the conveners of this parliament, in fact, you know, in Vivekananda's work, it's actually Hinduism, not Christianity, that's the flower of world religion. So yeah, there's a lot riding on this. He really, you know, I think he really feels himself to be an ambassador, and so he has to be careful because of all this well, to put it colloquially, bad mouthing of Hatha Yoga and bad mouthing of Hinduism more generally, in fact. So yeah, that's certainly going on.
Yeah. And I think chapters 2 and 3 of Yoga Body really spell out this particular historical moment and context that Vivekananda is kind of operating in. It's just so clearly. I think these chapters still for me just really hold up as just really important work of kind of documenting that period for the both Indian and European elites and shaping their thinking about these topics. So if that's where Vivekananda kind of lands, and even if he had a maybe lesser known Hatha Yoga guru, but still in his public presentations and in his writings, he's not emphasizing postural yoga in the way that, you know, that we now know of it, right? So something changes dramatically to get to the kind of post-World War II postural yoga boom and the teachings of, so many of the modern schools of yoga, from BKS Iyengar and the Tirumalai Krishnamacharya lineages to Shivananda, the Satyananda schools, as we were discussing, so on and so forth. There's such a huge gap, right, between what Vivekananda was teaching and writing about and then what we got later. And so your book, right, really helps to explain this shifting emphasis and the centering of the body and postural yoga. So what are some of the main arguments that you make in Yoga Body, and what's kind of the evidence and materials that you're looking at to make those arguments?
Yeah, so again, it's a cultural history of the body in some way. It's a cultural history of the body in yoga. And that's what I'm talking about when I say the yoga body. It's this sort of conception of what it is to practice yoga physically, and how that conception might change between contexts of the ancient past or traditional context in India, and what it might be in the more recent past, in the 20th century, in different context, in different countries, let's say. So let's just go back to Vivekananda for a moment. I think the impact of Vivekananda in presenting yoga and in his various books on yoga, I mean, he was much more than a yoga teacher. In fact, his role of a yoga teacher sort of began and ended in the United States in some respects with these books that he wrote and with the teaching that he did there. He was many other things. So if you look at his collected works, not much of it is about yoga. In fact, he's a much broader character than that. But the effect that his teachings had on what I call transnational Anglophone yoga. It's a bit of a mouthful, and it's a kind of formulation that can be picked apart. But I think in the sense that yoga teaching in English after Vivekananda that traveled around the world almost always owes a debt to him. So when we start to see the introduction of these physical practices by the likes of some of the most famous gurus of the time would have been Swami Puvalayananda with his center of study in Kaivalya Dham in Lonavala near Pune in Maharashtra in India, and Yogendra with his earliest modern yoga institute in Santa Cruz, also in southern India, where they're both they're both presenting something quite new. They're reworking the traditional asana, the traditions of asana within India along very different lines, and I'll go into that in a moment. But they're also, I think, they and many of the other innovators that kind of ride in the wake of Vivekananda's great revolution are basing themselves in the logic and the teachings of Vivekananda. So the postural element that comes in is not seen as a kind of break with that. It's seen as a deepening and a continuation, notwithstanding, of course, Vivekananda's own comments about asanas and how useless they are. And I think there's various reasons for this. One is that we have a vibrant history of practice of asana practice within the Indian tradition, which is there and which is can be drawn upon. And this was a period of and now I'm talking about sort of the last half of the 19th century, going back a bit before this next great wave, let's say the Hatha Yoga Renaissance in the broader world. What we see is a great interest in physical culture, generally speaking. And this is, so one of the arguments that I'm making in the book is that there was a worldwide revolution in physical culture, often associated with nation states, emerging nation states, and with nationalism, that worked along the logic that to have a strong nation, you had to have strong individuals. To have a strong state, you had to have strong individual bodies. And so this sort of notion kicked off a kind of huge enthusiasm for physical culture all the way around the world, starting in Europe and spreading out, you know, through India all the way to Japan, all the way around the world to Mao's China and so on. So we have this kind of culture emerging. And in India, you see something quite similar happening. You see a revival of traditional forms of physical disciplines, including martial arts, like fighting with a lathi, with a stick, including some southern Indian martial arts, including wrestling exercises and certain weightlifting exercises from within wrestling and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. But crucially, one of these elements is yoga, is yogasana. One of the elements that can be fitted into this new enthusiasm, let's say, for physical culture. And so what we see happening during that time is a kind of mixing. Because India is open and opening to the wider world, because of the encounter with colonialism, because of the presence of the British occupation of India over you know, a couple of centuries, there's a kind of opening. So the possibility to learn about physical culture in a global sense is suddenly there through cheap reproductions of books with drawings or photographs, through magazines. There are lots of those, and suddenly you start to have this global community of physical culture practitioners. And within India, one of the things that they are keen to represent is the wider yoga tradition. And in that way, you start to see asana becoming more visible as a practice in itself and as part and parcel of a broader sort of body of knowledge that's of physical culture. Mm. So that in a nutshell is, you know, that's the argument that I made, that asana came onto the world stage as part of a sort of a broader cultural movement that wasn't purely about yoga.
Mm. So the thesis turned book, Yoga Body, as we said, was published in 2010. So we're now, you know, in the 11th year, as we said, anniversary of the publication of this book. Since its publication, this book has had tremendous shelf life and influence, I would say, in numerous ways. You know, certainly within the academic fields of religious studies, South Asian studies, and now what we can call yoga studies. I think your book, again, building on earlier scholarship, but your book in particular has had a huge influence on this burgeoning field of yoga studies, and has influenced and inspired lots of generations of younger scholars, including myself. Reading this book was a game changer, really, for me in my understanding of all of what we're talking about. Outside of academia, though, this book has been widely read and purchased and received, more so typically than other academic monographs of dissertations turned books. No surprise, I think, given the topic and the public interest in yoga and the tens of millions of practitioners and teachers of yoga around the world. And in many ways, you know, this book, as the blurb on the back of it playfully says, Yoga Body turns conventional wisdom about yoga on its head. So I think, as you well know, this book has been both positively received and has also been very heavily criticized, and I would say also very misunderstood. And there's a wide range of receptions that this book has garnered, especially in more public and more yoga practitioner spaces. Can you talk a little bit about the reception of this book and what I hate to put this on you, but what are some of the things that you think that people are getting wrong about the book based on some of the feedback and criticism that you've received over the past 10 years?
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Seth. it has been an interesting process. Yeah. And when it was published in 2010, I think a lot of this stuff was quite new. A lot of the conversation was quite new, and it came in the wake of perhaps of conversations about the history of yoga that in some respects were not accurate according to me. So I knew that there was going to be some kind of controversy. At least I was working against the grain in some way. So if we're talking outside of academia, I mean, it's been a great privilege. I'm tremendously happy that the book has been read outside of the academic world as well as inside. You know, some of the other books that I've edited or written, you know, they tend to be only read by that small world, which, you know, which you also know very well. The misunderstandings, it has been sort of commonly understood that what I'm saying in the book is that yoga, and in particular asana, but sometimes it's extended to yoga, is a recent invention. That actually what I'm doing is denying the thousands of years of yoga tradition within India. And what I'm doing is claiming that yoga was invented not just recently, but outside of India. Mm-hmm. that it was invented by that it came from Scandinavian gymnastics is one of the allegations, one of the misunderstandings that's made about the book. Another one is that I'm saying that yoga is simply about asana or about keep fit or something like that, or about gymnastics. So it's that sort of idea. So the misunderstanding comes from thinking that what I'm doing is claiming something about the origins of yoga rather than trying to paint a picture of a particular period of time where and a particular cultural history where yoga does change. Because it seems to me undeniable, even from, within the staunchest traditionalist point of view, to see that yoga traditions and yoga has historical moments, that there's yogas, within Shaiva Tantra. There's also, there's Buddhist yoga, there's Hatha yoga, and that somehow what we see here are different phases of yoga history, that there always is change within yoga. So to describe this particular change, as I do, this particular change, which is perhaps faster and more wide-ranging and more radical than some of the earlier changes, because it's, opening yoga to the whole world. And to describe this cultural confluence and this cultural intermixture is really just that. It doesn't have anything to do with the origins of yoga or yoga per se. It's describing this situation that we find. So I think that's been the most difficult thing to explain. It seems to me a very simple idea, but I suspect sometimes that the book serves quite conveniently as a straw man. That's to say, it's useful for some people to argue that to use the book as a kind of target in order to say, to sort of say that, that this is all nonsense, and this and then for that same person to present what yoga really is. So it's useful, I think, and that's why perhaps sometimes the book has been misinterpreted, because it gives you something to rail against and then to state your opinion. But I don't know, even sort of 10, 11 years later, it seems to me that the thesis is fairly incontrovertible, or at least at least the picture that it describes is one worth considering and worth looking at, even if you might disagree with the conclusions, which I think are tentative, even if now 10, 11 years later, there's more information. The contexts have grown, all right? So the PhD was called The Context of Yoga in the Modern Age. It was about, it was all about context rather than origins.
Right. So didn't the book editors at Oxford University Press, they made you change the title, is that right?
Yeah, they didn't like the title, so it was called.
Was it The Body at the Center? Is that
The Body at the Center? Of course, yes, it was called. Thank you very much. I'm forgetting titles tonight.
It's okay.
It's called The Body at the Center: Context
you
of Modern.
Be expected culture. To remember your own titles.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a very sexy title, and it it was a more exact title. So. I don't know if that's what you were sort of referring to.
I think you hit it on the nail on the head. I would say the most common misunderstanding of the book and the way I see it targeted and criticized in various yoga circles, and oftentimes when I hear this, I get the sense that the person who is issuing that criticism actually has not read the book very closely, but they've heard somebody talk about it, or they read a blog piece about it, or whatever. I don't know who reads blogs anymore, but the idea that you are saying that yoga or asana was invented in the modern period, and moreover that the origins of that invention are non-Indic sources, that they come from Swedish gymnastics or the YMCA, and that there's this causal link and origins that they seem to think that you're claiming, which in many places in the book, you're quite careful to dispel that that's not the work that you're doing. Rather, you're trying to show these contexts and perhaps conceptual parallels between Indian Hatha yoga and modern postural yoga and some of these other physical cultural systems. However, I will say, if you flip open the book and you look at, you have these incredible images in the book. I mean, some of the archival images that you were able to gather from these English language manuals and primers are just incredible. You have these black and white stills. The montage from Thomas Dwight's Anatomy of a Contortionist, 1889. And then you have those contrasted with these asanas from BKS Iyengar's Light on Yoga. And they look like almost virtually identical bodily postures, right? And because Dwight's is of European origin, or was Thomas Dwight American? I forget, correct me if I'm
American. Yeah,
American, so. But 1889. And then, of course, Iyengar's Light on Yoga, 1966. The way the images are stacked next to each other, it might appear as if the author of this book is suggesting this one came first, therefore this one came from that. But if you read the text that accompanies it, you're clear to point out you're not making any causal link between these postures, but to show these strong associations. But tell us, a little bit more about that. What are you really saying here? What are we to make then of these strong associations, even with some of the very specific shapes of these yoga postures that we can detect in modern postural yoga, that we see with some earlier kind of American or European physical cultural contortionist or gymnastic programs?
Yeah. At the end of the PhD, I had an idea, that the next project that I wanted to do that I never did was to actually do a cultural history of contortionism within, in North America and Europe principally, but perhaps sort of further afield, to actually see, was there something more to contortionism than simply this display that we see, in this article from 1889. The contortionism is interesting to look at these days, because when you see something like that as a yoga practitioner, you think, ah, that's yoga. How odd. You know, there's somebody doing yoga. It doesn't seem to be called yoga, but obviously it must be related somehow. But I don't think so. And as I say, I haven't really done deep research into this, but I don't think it's related. It is a sort of display culture. It's an entertainment culture. And what it points to, I think, is the limitations of the body and also the limitations in the particular movements that a body can do. There's only so many. You know, there's quite a lot if we look at the sort of the range of things you can do in yoga or in contortionism. But those are two different worlds. So the point here really is that what we have is a kind of palimpsest. Or if you take a piece of tracing paper and you trace the same shapes of this contortionist from this magazine in 1889, and you know you overlay them onto these pictures of BKS Iyengar or whoever it might be doing what are yoga postures that have precedence in the Indian tradition. You put one piece of paper on top of the other and those line drawings match up completely. They are identical. There's a few differences, like the positions of the hands, that BKS Iyengar often has the hands in a prayer pose and the contortionist does not, but they look identical. Now, what's interesting and what's really the key, what this whole project of research is about, is to understand the difference beyond the mere appearance. So what is it that this contortionist thinks that he's doing? Mm. And compared to what is it that BKS Iyengar thinks that he's doing in these postures? And obviously he thinks that he's doing yoga. He knows that he's doing yoga because he's a yogi. So what I was interested in is the addition of cultural meaning onto shapes and onto practices that to outward perception might appear identical, but that aren't, because they carry a kind of baggage, a kind of cargo of cultural meaning. So, you know, another example might be, well, you know, an easy example would be yoga is keep fit. You know, one of the sort of the adaptations of yoga is keep fit, where you do particular postures that are obviously inspired by yoga, that come from yogic traditions, but that arguably have very little to do with the same postures performed in a traditional context at the end of the Kumbh Mela, you know, one of those great gatherings of sadhus in India, where also postural practice is key. So if you were to, you know, cut out a picture of that sort of, you know, keep fit yoga and put them with, you know, in the context of this traditional ascetic yoga, you have the appearance of the same thing, but you have very, very different experiences and realities being lived out in both contexts.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for explaining that further. So, I mean, in the 10 years, 11 years since the publication of this, it's not as if you quit or stopped researching or working. I think there's also sometimes the understanding that a book like this is sort of the final say on anything like this, when actually in some ways for you it was sort of marked the beginning of your explorations and research as the culmination of your dissertation project. Since then, you've gone on to publish several different books, edited volumes, and more recently, your collaborations with Jim Mallinson on Roots of Yoga, and then most recently, this incredible 5-year Hatha Yoga project with Jim, with Jason Birch, Daniela Bevilacqua, and other scholars in India. As this 5-year project comes to an end, and in kind of thinking back to Yoga Body, I mean, there's been this huge outpouring of research that has taken place since the publication of Yoga Body. We've learned so much about actually the history of asana, among other things. There's been so much more data from unpublished manuscripts, sculptures, paintings, you name it, that has come to light that simply was not even available at your disposal at the time of writing the book. What are some things, if any, you know, how have your views shifted at all, if at all, since the writing of Yoga Body, in terms of, let me put it more specifically, in terms of the connections between modern postural yoga or transnational Anglophone yoga and so-called pre-modern yogas, particularly let's kind of focus on asanas.
Sure. No, as you say, that there has been, you know, a great outpouring of work. It seems like we're in a kind of heyday of yoga studies. There's so much work being done, particularly based on textual evidence, you know, new texts that haven't really been in the academic focus before, and also work on material culture, including your own work, of course, on the sculptural representations of yoga postures in Hampi and other places, that have really, I think, moved on our understanding of that history within India and South Asia more generally. The work, maybe, you know, addressing the work that I did with Jim on Roots of Yoga, this compilation of practice material from primary sources, you know, I think we had a 112 or something texts that we sort of exploded and grouped according to, you know, according to their descriptions of particular practices, was really great to see a kind of emerge a sort of archaeology of practice. And since we're talking about asana today, you know, that chapter on asana, I think, shows it quite clearly that you have a development of asana in the pre-modern period that's quite clear from those very early seated postures in Patanjali, let's say, in the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, where I think there's 13 or 14 of them. They're all seated postures. You just supposed to sit down. Through that, you know, the Hatha Yoga revolution, you might say, where at the beginning of Hatha Yoga also, most of those early texts only describe one or two or three postures, and that, you know, they include usually Siddhasana, Padmasana, those seated postures. Mm-hmm. But then we see something else happening as and this is really the you know, a lot of this is about the work that's been done by my colleagues on the Hatha Yoga project, that's to say Jim, Jason and Daniela, who I know have featured in this podcast. And what they've shown, and, you know, with my small contribution within that, is that there was in fact a kind of proliferation of asanas, to use Jason's term, from sort of the 17th, 18th century onwards. So we start to see more of an interest in asanas in the texts, possibly, I think, as a result of Hatha Yoga from being a fringe practice, being absorbed into the sort of into a more mainstream culture, let's say, or more focus on certain practices of Hatha Yoga, including asana. So within the textual record, we can see that there is a development, you know, within this history of asana. And we, you know, we're looking, some of the additions that we're putting out, like the Yoga Chintamani, and perhaps also the, you know, the Hatabhyasa Padati, which we can talk about if you like, show clearly that there's something else going on. So that picture was absent from Yoga Body. And in fact, I think it's the first chapter of Yoga Body where I talk about yoga history and the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and so on. I think it reflects you know, you can see from now, having done all that work with Roots of Yoga and the Hatha Yoga Project, your own work and the work of other scholars, there's much more to say. There's much more that could come before that, and that would inform, in fact, you know, and provide additional context to that modern history. So that's certainly there, and I think it's really wonderful. We, you know, we've come to the end, the official end of the Hatha Yoga Project. We've got a little extension. We're still going, you know, sort of writing our monographs, our books. But, you know, the kind of the view that we have now, thanks to the work of all these scholars, is something quite different. It seems to me that that cultural history of the modern is still incredibly important for understanding where we are today, because, as I say, you know, the sort of the cultural meaning that accrues to these practices, or that is sort of embodied in these practices, that creates a kind of tradition that we've inherited today. So yes, that's a kind of context that really amplifies the history that I started out with, I suppose studying, 15 or 16 years ago.
Yeah, I really agree with all of that. I think although our knowledge of the pre-modern and early modern has expanded considerably, and we just know so much more than we did 10 years ago, it doesn't change or in some challenge, I think, the central thesis of your work, of Yoga Body, whereas there's still something quite new and modern that happens in the 19th and 20th, and certainly in the 21st centuries, that help to explain why yoga is and does, what it does today, why we think about yoga in the ways that we do, that still are quite remarkably distinct from the ways in which yoga is articulated in the pre-modern, even if there is much more asana, let's say, than previously accounted for. You mentioned the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati, and I do want to ask you about that because it is one of the really interesting, I think, gems of the Hatha Yoga project, and that in some ways is a really great example to highlight the richness of the tradition, we might say, on the cusp of modernity or on the cusp of the colonial period. I think you guys have dated the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati to the 18th century. I know this is a text you've worked on really closely with Jason Birch, and you've recently published an article in the Journal of Yoga Studies demonstrating some of your key findings, summarizing what you've done with this text. Tell us just a little bit about it and why it's significant, and then also, if we can, maybe briefly, just connect this to Krishnamacharya's yoga and whether or not you think he was aware of this text.
Sure. So yes, I think probably a late 18th century text from Maharashtra, from sort of the Pune area of India, and it's we think it's called the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati. It appears to be called that. The text appears to sort of name itself like that. But of course, it's a general name, sort of an instruction book on the practice of Hatha. It's not a very it's a fairly generic name. But anyway, this text has a range of practices that it describes. It's not clear that the single manuscript that initially we were working with was a complete text, and there's no colophon, that this sort of end point of a text that says where it's composed and when it's composed and so on and who it's composed by. We don't have that. But late 18th century describes a range of Hatha practices, including some very interesting details on how to construct the yogi's hut. And you need several huts for different practices, some of which need a great height, some of which are smaller. We have some very unique, really unique details on some of the more arcane practices of Hatha Yoga, like Vajrayogi Mudra. Mm. And lots of quite fascinating elements. But possibly what's most interesting about the text is the asana section, where it describes a large number of postures that are divided, it appears, into six blocks, which may be six sequences. That's sort of an argument that we consider at great length in that article, whether or not these groupings of postures, which are, for example, prone postures, or postures beginning from a prone position, supine postures or beginning from a supine position, standing postures and so on, whether these are just groupings of postures or whether they are intended to be performed as a sequence. All right. If they are, and there's some strong evidence to suggest that at least in part they are intended to be performed as a sequence, it's sort of the first time that we see this happening, and the only time we see this happening before sort of modern sequential yoga practices. Okay, so it's really quite a landmark. We also see a large number of very unusual postures that don't occur anywhere else, suggesting that it comes from another stream of yoga practice. You know, it's that we weren't until that point aware of, and some dynamic postures as well, such as jumping up and down, standing on one leg and holding the big toe and spinning around, and practices that are actually quite hard. So we did sort of a research that we coined embodied philology being the study of text. We got practitioners in to perform these groups of postures, and it's extremely challenging. It's a really, really hard thing to do. You know, you can't simply start at the beginning as an untrained, or you know, for most people, I think it would be impossible, really, without an immense amount of practice to accomplish all of these postures.
We had Ruth Westerby on recently, telling us about her experience as one of the practice subjects, let's say, of this embodied philology. And Ruth is an extraordinarily strong and flexible and able-bodied practitioner, saying, you know, how difficult the sequences are.
Yes. Yes, and you know, Ruth is a long-term advanced Ashtanga practitioner. Yeah, some of these things are just very challenging indeed. So that's really interesting from the point of view of the practice of yoga and what it means. Why would you do such things that are so intensely physical? When, for instance, in the Hatha Pradipika, one of the counterindications of yoga practice is that you shouldn't be overexerting yourself. Well, you sort of have to in this text. You know, it's kind of, it points towards a different kind of culture, which perhaps is associated with physical culture disciplines from outside of yoga. Perhaps what's going on is a kind of osmosis between other traditions of perhaps military training, other kinds of body discipline that are being assimilated into yoga. And of course, this is something that we see not just in asana, but in sort of shatkarmas within mudra. We see a kind of assimilation of other things within to the fold of yoga over this period, and perhaps that's what's happening here. So anyway, it's a fascinating text. I'd recommend, you know, having a look at the article and also having a look at the website. I think it's hatabhyasapadhati.org. And there'll be a film. We've already, you know, there's a film of this sort of experiment of the performance of the asanas.
Yeah, we're gonna have Jacqueline Hargreaves on here soon, who's behind the making of the film, right? And we'll be able to talk in more detail about that, and looking forward to that debut.
Absolutely.
And another reason, though, and I mentioned that this perhaps is significant, is because there does seem to be a highly likely probability that Krishnamacharya was aware of some version of this manuscript. Is that right?
That's right. The text, the Hatabhyasapadhati, a version of it, seems to have been at the basis of a book called the Sri Tattva Niti, or at least a section of the Sri Tattva Niti dealing with asanas, which was written about in the yoga tradition of the Mysore Palace, a book by Norman Shoman. but also, another kind of recent discovery, that there is a manuscript of the Hatabhyasapadhati within the Mysore Library, or at least there used to be. And I think we can be pretty sure, we know that Krishnamacharya was aware of the Sri Tattva Niti, because he lists it as one of his sources in his 1934 book, The Yoga Makaranda. So he knew about it. But in a later book, Yoga Sunagalu, he mentions this Yoga Kurunta, or Yoga Kurunti, I think he calls it in that book, which of course is this legendary text that's often evoked but has never been seen, which is supposedly the origin and the source of the practices of Ashtanga Yoga, Ashtanga Vinyasa Yoga. So I'm not talking about Patanjali, I'm talking about the yoga of Pattabhi Joyce, Krishnamacharya's student Pattabhi Joyce. Mm-hmm. So it's quite possible that Krishnamacharya knew about this book because the author of the Hatabhyasapadati appears to be called Kapala Kuruntaka. So one of the things I've played with over the course of this article and you know the edition that's coming out is that actually this Kapala Kuruntaka, the Yoga Kurunta, is a reference to the author of this text, and that this text, the Yoga Kurunta, is in fact the Hatabhyasapadati. And if you read the article, you'll see our considered assessment of that claim. And I think it's probably true that Krishnamacharya took inspiration both from the Sri Tattvaniti and from this other text, perhaps in the construction of his sequences. However, unfortunately, it's not the answer to the conundrum. It seems to me that the evidence suggests that although Krishnamacharya was drawing on many different sources and may have perhaps derived a kind of shastric authorization for postural sequences from this particular text, I don't think in any way we can identify the Hatabhyasapadati with the Yoga Kurunta, unfortunately. That would have been very, very exciting indeed. Mm. But that nevertheless, it sort of does have a part to play within Krishnamacharya's formulation of yoga. So it's a kind of tentative conclusion, but, you know, quite an exciting sort of piece of the puzzle, I think, in terms of the history of modern yoga.
Definitely. And you've been editing and translating with Jason the Hatabhyasapadati. Is it in its entirety, or is it maybe sections of the text? Is that something that folks can expect to read a publication of in English translation sometime soon?
Yes, it's ready. In fact, I think it's the first of the 10 critical editions that we finished. So it's actually all done. We've written the introduction and the translation is there. And I'm not sure exactly when it's coming out, but it'll be published with the EFEO in Pondicherry, hopefully sometime next year. I'm not exactly sure, but it's ready, it's done, and it's on its way.
And Jim had mentioned that you guys are going to have open source or open access editions that will be able to be freely downloaded. Is that still true?
That's right. Yeah, that's one of the conditions of the ERC, the European Research Council's grant that we got for 5 years. So it's all this material will be freely available.
Wow!
So you can download it as a PDF.
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, I know our time is winding down here. I have so many other questions to ask you about so many different directions, but I'm going to restrain myself. But I do want to just ask you briefly here about what you're currently working on. You mentioned the monograph, the book that you're writing for the project. You've got an extension here to finish that. Tell us a little bit about what you've been up to in addition to working on some of the editions like the Hatabhyasapadati. What's the current Mark Singleton project?
Yeah, the book is about yoga in relationship to technology. And it's, you know, if the work in Roots of Yoga was about the sort of the deep past of yoga, let's say, and then Yoga Body, the sort of the emergence of a modern yoga. What I wanted to look at in this book is the embrace of technology within yoga over the last 10 years or so, and the ongoing encounter of yoga with technology. I'm looking at this in on several different levels. One is a sort of ethnography, you might say, of yoga in relation to technology. How sort of I'm going to call them banal technologies, sort of, you know, what are now ordinary technologies of yoga are starting to influence the way people practice and the understanding of practice. So things like sensor yoga mats and wearables that can actually tell you how to practice yoga in conjunction with an app on your phone. On that level, I'm interested in the kind of tracking process, in the kind of linking of the human to the machine in order to practice yoga. It seems to me that that's not entirely new. We've seen that throughout the modern history of yoga, people getting linked up to machines. But that this is part and parcel of something like a new religion of data. And it's sort of, it seems to me, another little turn, or a major turn perhaps, in this history of yoga, where we are becoming something like a cyborg. We're becoming part machine. And I'm not the first to make this argument, but I think, you know, in the context of yoga, it's quite interesting. So on the one hand, you have things like that. You have, you know, ways to map your practice. You have ways to map your brain waves through, you know, sort of headsets, and these meditation headsets have been well studied already. You're also seeing technologies which don't just reflect back to you your own experience and track it, but technologies that claim to be able to adjust your experience. So headsets that can actually change your brainwaves, that can change the way you experience reality, much like perhaps, and this is the open question in the book, much like yogis, you know. And so the question is, you know, at this point, is there a philosophical compatibility with the use of technology in order to attain yogic states of awareness, states of bliss, and so on, and you know, the traditional yoga sadhana? So I'm looking at things like that, like biohacking as well, and those sort of cultures within yoga, which seem to me still quite niche, but sort of on their way, and very much sort of entering into yoga. So that's a very quick sort of overview of what I'm doing. I'm looking at sort of the neo hyper modernism of yoga, to borrow a phrase from Bruno Latour.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, I mean, if we think of yoga over the centuries at its core as a discipline for controlling, manipulating, and mastering the mind and the body, changing states of consciousness. In that way, it's very much like a technology of the self, right? To quote Foucault. This sounds like a fascinating project. I'm excited to see where you go with it. It brings so much of very timely, current, and even futuristic discourses to bear with yoga. And I understand this is something you'll be talking about in the upcoming Yogic Studies course. Is that right? I think in Module 4, you'll maybe be sharing some of this with us as we think about the future of yoga.
That's exactly right. Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, the fourth module is sort of new directions, you know, what it is, what's happening now. You know, we appear to be in a moment of such rapid and major transition in the world, you know, from climate change to COVID to the massive growth of technology. This is what I'd like to focus on in that final module. Definitely.
Well, fantastic. Mark, I mean, thank you so much for just taking the time here with me. I could go on and on for hours, honestly, but it's been a real pleasure to hear more about your story, your truly pioneering scholarship. And I have to share with our listeners, you've recently announced that you'll be retiring from the field of yoga studies and doing this type of scholarship, which I have to say is really a great loss for the field. You're really just an incredible thinker and scholar pushing the field forward. So I'm glad you're going to at least put out this last book. I'm incredibly grateful you're going to teach this upcoming online course for us. But on the other side, congratulations on your retirement.
Thanks very much, Seth. You know, I'm retiring in one way, but not in another. You know, life goes on, and it's been really an incredible privilege to be working in this field, and also a real joy, and a real joy to be able to take part in these conversations. So thanks to you, and I greatly look forward to teaching this course.
Yeah, well, I hope you'll continue the conversations, and you'll be a forever emeritus to the field. And again, thanks for the conversation. We look forward to the course, which begins on January 4th. We're going to start off the future, 2021, the new year, with thinking about yoga's past, present, and future with Mark Singleton. So, yeah, thanks again, Mark. Please take care, be safe, and we'll be in touch very soon, okay?
Thanks very much, Seth. I look forward to it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or sharing this episode with someone else. Thanks so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care.